So this is the bit before the opening title music.
Exactly.
Okay.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
Hey, you've got 3 seconds for it.
I'm going to amp this baby up, see how it sounds.
Thanks for listening. This is the FakeShemp.net podcast. My name's Glenn.
And I'm Jared.
And we're here as always, but this time without Sean again.
Yeah, he's in Thailand.
He's getting...
loose.
He's getting loose.
Loose.
Loose. Very loose by the looks of it. So
yeah.
We don't have him with us this episode. However, we do have a special guest that's going to pop up later. And let's do the reveal now. It is Clint Howard.
Clint Howard.
I'm like gushing fanboy here.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. I dare say he's the biggest guest we've ever had on the podcast.
I reckon between him and Harlan Williams.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. So, yeah, stick around because pretty soon we're going to be talking about the 1986 cult film The Wraith.
The Wraith.
How good's The Wraith? But we'll talk about that soon.
In depth.
In depth. So let's kick it off. Don't forget, you can listen to us on iTunes, Podbean and Stitcher. Catch us on
SoundCloud.
Very funny man.
Okay, you're not on SoundCloud.
We talked about that last time.
Oh yes, that's right. It was quite late. Yeah, that's right. Yes,
yeah, we are on SoundCloud, but we're not going to pay for a subscription there for only three episodes at a time.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you want to hear this one, it'll be on SoundCloud and the last two.
Yeah.
But
if you want to dip into the deep back cat, you got to go to Podbean or iTunes
or even our website.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I digress. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Come and play. So anyway, what's news? What do you want to talk about? Let's just... for anyone that's never listened before and it's your first time, that's all we do. We just talk shit about movies.
I went to the Sydney Underground Film Festival last weekend with work.
Cool.
I saw one movie.
It
runs over the course of 4 days. It opened on a Thursday, but I was there from the Friday night. But did see a doco, Dead Hands Dig Deep, that Monster Pictures are distributing. Really cool documentary. Aside from that, I attended a few masterclasses, so actually listening to filmmakers talk about films and whatnot.
Cool.
The lineup was awesome. They were playing a Linklater doco I really wanted to see.
Really?
I know. I didn't even know there was a doco.
No, me neither.
It's funny because I often hear the question, should you make a documentary on a filmmaker before, the career's sort of over? I don't know, that was probably not the right way to phrase it, but in my mind, Linklater makes so many films, the guy's so prolific, you better start making a documentary now, because it's got to be like 40
photos. But then my theory with that is that then, 10, 15 years down the road, that documentary becomes insignificant.
I don't know, I guess it's like a time capsule of that period.
Unless you follow it up with
like a volume 2 sort of thing. Well, there's that documentary, Document of the Dead, on George Romero making Dawn of the Dead, but then every now and again he goes back, the director, and taps on like an extra 10 minutes.
That is some of the most boring narration I've ever heard.
Yeah, I know, I still like it though. Just because you get to see behind the scenes.
One of the very first horror VHS I ever purchased as a little kid, my nana took me to a video store, Full FX Rentals. I bought Document of the Dead thinking it was a genuine horror film.
Well, because the artwork was like Creepshow on the front. They used like Creepshow type of art with a Cryptkeeper.
And I was devastated as a kid. It's another example of when I went to get Star Wars but ended up getting one of those
SFX or something, one of those making offs.
I'm not old enough to go back by myself and replace it. I know it well.
So, I don't know. It's like kind of... It is a bit of an interesting question. Do you make a documentary on a filmmaker before their career's up? And I just watched the De Palma doco, which I really enjoyed. But he actually brings up an interesting question about filmmakers. And he said they generally make their best films in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. But it's clear De Palma's like 70, 71 now, maybe even toward his mid-70s. So it was an interesting statement for him to make toward the end of the documentary, and the last few films that are covered, like Redacted and Passions, they're not really spoken about in great length, but he did go to say that with Passions, he tried to return to do the films that, that he had loved making the most, which are those very Hitchcockian type of thrillers.
Very hard thing to do when there's a different... climate of film and different technologies and
absolutely and I think that's De Palma was a master of visual style and suspense and so many different other things throughout the 70s, 80s and the 90s, and even into the early 2000s. I can't remember what year Snake Eyes was. That would have been about 2000, yeah?
Yeah.
And that fucking holds up. It's a solid movie. But yeah, his latter stuff, like Passions, you watch, and it really does. It was either Passion or Passions. I can't remember now. Passions was that... that awful TV series from the 90s, the midgets, yeah. So maybe it's called Timmy, Passion. Timmy, yeah, yeah, that's it. But it very much harks back to his films from like split screen use into it, into the real sexualized violence and misogyny that plays a heavy part in
the things we love, you know, about
yeah, the fine qualities of the
that we talked film. About on yeah. a previous episode.
Well, we did, yeah. One film actually that did come up briefly in the documentary that I think maybe is his most accomplished latter work was that. Was it Femme Fatale? Is it Femme Fatale? Is that the one with Antonio Banderas?
Yes. No, yes, Femme Fatale.
Yeah, Femme Fatale, yeah.
And fucking... was it Rebecca Stamos?
Yes, it was, yeah. And that was one that I didn't actually see till my De Palma Renaissance about 4 years ago. And when I watched it, I was like, oh, I can't believe I have not seen this film. It fits so well with that early work for him. But yeah, that doco... I mean, let's face it, De Palma's best years are behind him, so it makes sense that the doco's made now.
Sure, sure.
So, but yeah, Linklater, I think we've still got a lot of great years ahead of us. I mean, is that still your favourite film of the year so far? Yeah, everybody wants some.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean...
And how weird is it that Reel are putting that out on DVD and Blu-ray? It's not Roadshow. Why have Roadshow dumped it to Reel?
Odd.
Very strange decision. Odd. But anyway...
But but they work in hand in hand, you know, Reel and Roadshow. But
it's true.
Speaking of Everybody Wants Some, another retro film I saw this week was called Girl Asleep.
Australian film,
which I believe played at Melbourne International Film Festival.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
this is a film that's kind of like, I guess, you could compare it to, you know, Spike Jonze meets Napoleon Dynamite, bit of
Wes Anderson. Yeah, it does have that kind of look to it.
Yeah, it's
set in the '80s, but it has that kind of strange
even late 70s, I think. Right. And that's, yeah, it's a fantasy film. It's drama. It's very funny. It's strangely 4.3 in ratio.
Yeah,
all the way through. But I guess that is kind of throwing back to
It's an aesthetic decision for the time,
Which makes a difference on a cinema screen.
And what is like, you know, I have a limited understanding of the film. I've only seen the trailer. So what's the basic premise of
the basic premise? Girl and her family move into a new town. She moves into a new school where she becomes victim of the local clique. So there's that mean girls element.
Yeah.
The school's loser befriends her and they become very close.
Right.
And to deal with the trauma around her and the embarrassment from her family, who are a very ochre, daggy kind of family that humiliate her almost deliberately.
Right.
She just withdraws into a fantasy world.
Okay.
And the fantasy world is half of the film almost. It's just a really elaborate kind of thing, you know. If you can remember the fantasy underworld elements of Stranger Things, that TV series on Netflix, it's that kind of environment. Like, just strange and...
Yep.
Yeah, but it's great. It's worth a look. I just thought I'd give it a shout because... I've mentioned it to a lot of people. They've never heard of it.
Yeah. Well, it's Umbrella that are distributing it here and theatrically on home end. So it's had a very sort of quiet... But it's still in theatres. Like, it opened a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, selected theatres. I think it's still playing at... Like, in Melbourne, it's playing at Nova and maybe Kino and out here in the Burbs. And
I definitely want to check that one out before it finishes because I'm disappointed I missed Down Under as well, which was the Aussie one that came out, had a limited release, and that's all but done now.
Looking forward to that one. Before we move on, did you hear that I read this today that John Carpenter has finally come out and spoken about Rob Zombie's Halloween?
But did you see what the context was that he'd said that, you know, he kind of just stayed quiet about it, and it wasn't until he saw a documentary made for TV doco, which I think might be the History Channel doco on Halloween, and when they speak to Rob Zombie had said that John Carpenter was a bit standoffish and dismissive. And John Carpenter's basically like, I never said that. I encouraged him to make his own film and all this.
Yeah.
And then he called him a lying piece of shit. And I'm like, fuck yeah.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
And
wouldn't it have been a better story for Rob Zombie to say, I've got his blessing to make my own movie and that's why I made
it. He might have got away with it.
You know?
And the thing
he'll never get away with Halloween 2, but maybe the first.
But the thing I love about what Carpenter had, the issues he had with it were the exact same things I had issues with, so it reassured me.
Yeah, totally. Destroying the mystique of Michael Myers, not needing to know everything, it makes perfect
sense. Giving too much away.
Yeah.
Yeah, just I love that he's finally come out and said this. For us film nerds, it's like, you know.
Totally. And it's rare that you do get to, you know, everyone sort of bites their tongue and just says, you know.
He's old enough now that he doesn't give a shit.
No. And now he's got to sit through it again next year when they do the next incarnation of Halloween, where they completely reboot it for another time. At a point in time, that was going to be a direct sequel.
Isn't he attached, though?
Oh, he's always attached as an associate or executive producer. I mean, he's still going to see some cash out of it. I really want to hear what he's got to say about the Fog remake. With Smallville's, what's his name? Tom Wellings?
Wellings.
Something like that.
Yeah.
That one's a piece of shit. I own it because it's got, you know, it's Todd Carpenter talking about the original Fog.
But why would you have digital Fog when
real Fog is such an easy effect to do? Yeah, I don't know, that movie was balls. All balls. And the fact it was rated like PG-13 or whatnot in the US, it was never going to be great. And there's no unrated version, so anyway. So yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm glad to hear that, you know, John Carpenter spoke out. But Rob Zombie, he's got his new film, 31.
31.
Had mixed reviews so far. Yeah. It sounds like the diehard Rob Zombie fans are very happy. Everyone else is a little bit like, why is this guy still making movies? I mean, you didn't mind Lords of Salem.
I hated Lords of Salem. See, no, I really loved it. And what I'm going into this one just completely ambiguous. Like, I don't care.
It looks like he's dropped a bit of that kind of art aspect of what Lords of Salem was, where it was kind of had it in my mind.
Textually, it looks more like his first film.
Yeah, it's more like A House of a Thousand Corpses or Devil's Rejects. What, I haven't seen it either, and I'm keen to see it.
I seem to have this hang up that I really don't like it when horror filmmakers monster up their clowns. I think clowns are scary as clowns. Totally. Like the pure clowns.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, Clown House and things like that. Yeah. And when you turn them into monsters with exaggerated features, it loses. It's
just redundant.
It loses the creepy factor.
Totally.
And Rob Zombie seems to like to just trailer park them, you know, like he trashes them
trailer
up.
Park and carnival everything. That's the the general Rob Zombie
but
aesthetic.
He makes them grotty and grimy, and I don't think that makes them scarier.
No. What scares me is Sherry Moon Zombie's acting.
She in this one?
Of course she is. It's contractually obligated that she's in everything
he does. One of the worst Q&A's ever was listening to her talk.
Oh, was she there at the Devil's Rejects screening?
It was both of them on the stage, and he was great to listen to. She was fucking atrocious, and of course, being the, you know, wrapped around her finger, he just let her do all the talking, and everyone came to see him.
No one wants to hear from her. We've got to see enough of her in the movie.
Yeah, that's right. Oh god.
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, shall we move on?
We shall.
Anything you want to add?
No, I think that's generally it, my good man.
Okie doke. Let's move on to our focus film.
Opens Friday, November 21st at a theater near you.
1986, The Wraith.
1986. I saw it in 87 when it surfaced on video. I don't know if it came out of the movies here in Australia. I just remember it having that awesome artwork on video. It had that really cool lenticular cover that you move.
It was like a foil.
Yeah, it was like a foil lenticular-y sort of thing. It was the exact same time The Gate came out. Yeah, and that's Palace foil as well. Yeah. So they both had that sweet, sweet cover. But I remember seeing the trailer on a heap of those Palace Home Entertainment movies and going, this fucking look cool. Yeah. I gotta see this shit.
I'll tell you what, and it is a cool film. It was directed by Mike Marvin, who also made Hamburger the Motion Picture.
No, are you fucking serious?
Yes, indeed.
Oh my god, I didn't realise that. I love like Hamburger and Stitches, which are both Palace Home Entertainment films.
Yeah.
No, Hamburger the Motion Picture, fantastic. Critically, I can't understand why the fuck is that thing not being released on DVD.
I know.
It breaks my heart. I've still got the video.
So the film stars Charlie Sheen, Sherilyn Fenn, Nick Cassavetes, Randy Quaid, and of course Clint Howard, amongst others. This is a film that has stood up really well. I kind of thought going into it, it's been a long time since I've watched it, but I remember it very well. And everything about it holds up. You know, it is a product of its time, but it's aged really nicely.
It has. Visually, it still looks great. Like, all the optical effects still look pretty pristine.
We watched, of course, a Blu-ray that I sourced from Spain, I think it was. Yeah, it was like a Spanish one. Which, at one moment, it reverted back to Spanish, which was interesting, but only 5 seconds worth.
Yeah, it's like nothing.
Yeah. But it looked mint.
Yeah, I've never seen it look this good. I've got the old Force DVD that came out at some point in the early 2000s, and even that looked pretty sweet. I was so used to like the 4x3 bloody rough, you know, tracking ridden horror video. So seeing it on high def tonight.
So the gist of the film, if no one has seen it, which, you know, you have to go see it, it is all about the Wraith is a mysterious, I guess, alien-like character that sort of comes from nowhere and then takes on a gang that are notorious for street racing and have murdered someone in the past. This Wraith is a victim that comes back and wreaks havoc and seeks revenge. And in many ways, it's a very similar parallel to The Crow.
Yeah.
You know? And I wonder if The Crow was inspired by this because the comic book, I believe, came later.
Yeah, right.
But they're very similar.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah, it's like Mad Max meets The Crow.
Yeah, that's the perfect way to put it, really. Yeah. And what I love about this film, and it holds true now, is that it's really seamless for me. Like, watching this, the narrative just flows really, really well. Fluently.
It's like a fast 80, 90 minutes that it runs.
And there's never that lull moment. No. It's like every scene is a means to progress the story.
Yeah, absolutely, to move it forward to the next spot.
So, What are your memories of this film other than watching it when it first came out with that foil cover? Like,
yeah, well, that's the weird thing. Like, I remember watching it a number of times on video as a kid, and it wasn't until I revisited it into the early 2000s that I kind of clicked. Charlie Sheen's the fucking lead in this movie.
Yeah.
I remember Charlie Sheen, you know, at the time, by the time it had surfaced in Australia, he would have been in Wall Street. That would have come out in 87. So that actually probably just came out maybe before this on Home Ed.
And of course, Platoon.
And Platoon, yes. Platoon's Charlie Sheen. So that was like a real revelation when I went back and rewatched it. I went, fuck yeah, Charlie Sheen. And he's not a lot of screen time for Charlie Sheen.
I was about to say, for a lead, he doesn't take up the amount of screen time that everyone else does.
No.
Very limited.
Technically, he's the lead, but he's in it the least.
Yeah. But his character has a presence.
Yeah. No, yeah, and I wasn't, you know, growing up as a kid in the 80s, I was a massive horror movie fan, and I think, you know, the action stuff, I liked it if it was Schwarzenegger or someone like that, like a big sort of action hero that was the lead, but generally the smaller stuff I wasn't too big on. But I think there was enough parallels with this film being kind of like a sci-fi element of horror about it.
Heavily genre-based.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that we picked up tonight that I hadn't picked up prior, that we'd kind of discussed, and we didn't know if it was intended or not, that, you know, Randy Quaid's sheriff character surname's Loomis, and we're like, is that a reference to Halloween? And then there's another line in it where he said, you know, I don't know who he is, but he's weird and pissed off, and it's a very similar line from The Thing. So we're like, are these references?
And did we miss other references?
Yeah, exactly, because we weren't aware of it until that latter point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I should have really looked at Mike Marvin's, you know, actual filmography to say.
I don't think it's huge.
Yeah, I just can't believe that he did Hamburger the Motion Picture. Fucking, that is amazing. Like, I really love that movie. More beef in every bite.
Yeah, for sure.
We need to do that as a focus film sometime.
I reckon.
You have to get Mike Marvin. Is Mike Marvin still kidding? Is he still out there?
Probably. I didn't read that he passed.
Well, if we ever do Hamburg, let's get him on the...
Let's do that. Let's track him down. So the film came along at a time in the 80s when dystopian sci-fi films were sort of really popular. Following, not that it was kind of sci-fi, the first Mad Max and all that. And even there's elements of Terminator in this film, particularly when he walks into a building.
Yeah, you know,
gun in hand. Even the, like, the Exterminator.
The Exterminator films.
That kind of stuff. So, and supernatural revenge films, they were all the rage at that time. So this sort of, I think, has outlasted a lot of them. It really sort of sticks out in my mind.
It doesn't feel like it's stuck in the period either.
No.
Like, the other thing I was going to mention is that there's a heavy punk influence in it too. Not necessarily on the soundtrack, although you do have like Billy Idol on there, but you've got two characters there, you know.
Very dead-end driving kind of...
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so, yeah, seeing them was, almost akin even to like Return of the Living Dead or...
Yeah.
You know, and I guess it was the same year. You know, it was about 85, 86 that those two were made. But I was going to mention the soundtrack. Yep. Like the fucking soundtrack. Like, amazing. How many bands, like... Yeah, Robert Palmer's on it. That blew my mind. I couldn't remember Robert Palmer having been on it, but yeah, having him on there amongst having Motley Crue and like I mentioned, Billy Idol, and you said earlier,
I think Ozzy Osbourne sounded like Ozzy Osbourne. I didn't look it up before we recorded, but It's
but then a lot of other tracks that you've heard that I couldn't name the artist of. So it's a pretty big.
But most amazing of all is that Robert Palmer's song is the standout song. Like it's the one song that they play almost in entirety.
Yeah. Like way too loud, so you can't even hear really any of the dialogue.
Strange. But yeah, look, this is a film I used to watch on VHS all the time. Stop, rewind it, and movie scenes and things like that. And it was just a wonderful thing.
No, absolutely. And I think one of the strengths of it, as why it hasn't dated, apart from, you know, the optical effects holding up and that, is because it's set out like in the Arizona desert too. It's not like everything's super dependent on fashion and that. There's a real greaser sort of thing to the race car, you know, sort of style, the punk sort of look that hasn't really changed over the years.
It's an ageless part of America. Absolutely. Like timeless, you know.
And Sherilyn Fenn dressed in clothes that would suit the climate of the Arizona desert, and we both say thumbs up to that.
Yes, absolutely.
She looks stunning. I don't think she's ever looked better than she has in this.
No, I agree.
Incredible.
So what I thought, just less than 24 hours ago, I thought, you know what? We quite often reach out to actors, you know, to have them on and share some stories, and I thought, fuck it. Like, the standout character in this, iconically and sort of visually, is Rughead, which is Clint Howard's character, who's like the nerdy scientist of the gang that works on all the cars and gets them charged up and whatnot. So I just sent him a message and boom, he replied and he wants to...
Incredible.
He wanted to share some information. So rather than us talk about the film,
you
know, he gives us far more insight to backstory, all that kind of stuff. So let's have a listen to him now.
When Daryl, my agent, called me about The Wraith in January of 1986. Oh, I was, 25 years old, and I had done a few movies, I played a few characters, but I saw this Rughead as an opportunity to really solidify myself as a full-blown character actor. You know, my hair had fallen out, and yet it seemed like they wanted me to have this eraser head hair. So I went in and auditioned. As it turns out, Mike Marvin later told me he had decided to use me the night before because he had seen this short film that Michael Keaton directed that I worked in with him. It was on the David Letterman Film Festival. And Keaton just killed as a director, and he did a funny thing, and I was pretty good. And Mike saw it, and he knew I was going to play Rughead after that. So the cast got assembled. I was actually at the audition with, like, Chris and Griff, and I think Jamie was there. I think they had all the finalists there. And I remember packing a bag and getting ready to go to Tucson, and it was a big deal because, you know, still a young guy, hadn't been doing this on my own for too much time, and it felt like it was going to be a fun experience, and it was. It happens very rarely. It's happened to me twice where I've worked on a movie and created friendships that go way beyond just business. Apollo 13 was a wonderful example of that. I met some wonderful, wonderful friends. It was just a good time in my life. But also The Wraith. There was this collection of people, young people, Nick Cassavetes and Charlie, and Charlie was just a pup, and Chris Nash and Griffin O'Neill and Jamie Bosie and Dave Sherrill, and Johnny Depp is hanging out because he happens to be the boyfriend of Sherilyn Fenn. So anyway, it was just this wonderful circus that us actors got to participate in for... Oh, I don't know. I think I saw somewhere recently that they shot for 42 days, which, Jesus, that's a lot in this day and age. But we were there in Houston. In Tucson. And I do remember that's when the Challenger crashed. That's, you know, time and a place when something happens in your life. It happened to be on the Wraith. I was gone. I had finished and wrapped and gone home. By the time there was the car wreck, or the camera truck spun out, and there was a death, and there's a couple of bad injuries, and I know it left a bad stain on Mike's brain, and that kind of tainted the movie a little bit. Anyway, the fun of working in Tucson with a gang like Charlie Sheen and Chris Nash and Jamie Bosie and Dave Sherrill, Oh yeah, and there's Nick Cassavetes. It was an all-timer. I'll never forget at the Holiday Inn Cocktail Lounge. There was a guy that had a one-man band thing going. It was, you know, he was the lounge lizard, and he had the drums, and he was a one-man band. And we finished work, and we wanted to go in and have a couple of cool adult beverages because we were adults at that time. And Charlie actually pulled out a $100 bill and asked this fellow if he wouldn't play, because it was sort of annoying. And the guy thought about it. He almost took Charlie's money, but then he said he thought he'd probably get fired if he took the money. So Charlie, with a smile on his face, said he understood, and I think we went upstairs to his room. we had a time. Nick and I, a little older than Charlie, and there was one opportunity where it seemed like the window was going to be open to go to Las Vegas. Short flight from Tucson to Vegas. And so Nick and I probably had done it a few more times than Charlie, and we sort of scheduled a trip, and I know Nick likes to flip cards, and I like to see bones roll, and I know Charlie's hardly ever turned down any kind of a wagering opportunity. We went to Vegas, and we had a great time, and it was fun, and you know, it was a little like Hangover. There was a time when I lost track of the fellas, and anyway, we get back on the plane and we come home, and it's Monday morning. Charlie was expecting to not have to work, and something had happened, and they had changed the schedule, and they had moved a fairly significant scene that Charlie was supposed to do right into that spot on Monday morning. And boy, oh boy, Charlie was a sick little boy. And he paid the price that day. Nick and I, we had the day off. We went right to bed. There's one more thing about the Wraith that always sort of bothered me a little bit. This John Kimmeny fellow, who was the producer, he really thought he was just the cat's meow. And he was the wizard of all wizards. And, you know, he put this young cast together. We went to Tucson. And a few of us had inquired about seeing dailies, at which point John Kimmeny, everybody concerned, said, "Oh no, you can't see dailies. It's our policy not to show you dailies." Now, I'd been working in the business for about 25 years. You know, Nick was bred into the business. So is Charlie. I mean, come on. We want to see some dailies. Well, they wouldn't let us, so that wouldn't stop us. They were showing the dailies, and they weren't really dailies. I think they were weeklies. They would show them in the conference room of the Holiday Inn we were staying at. And we knew when they were going to be, and there was a few of us. I don't think it was the whole herd, but there was a few of us. I was there. We went inside the room, the conference room, underneath the tablecloths of the tables, and we watched dailies while the asshole adults were, you know, watching dailies. You know, listen, after about 30 seconds or a minute of seeing dailies, I'm fine. I'm ready to go. I'm just kind of curious to see how it's looking. So that was a case where the producers thought they knew best, and I think time lets them know that they were wrong. Great memories working on the Wraith, and my personal relationships with Jamie and Dave and Charlie and Nick. It's just one of those deals where when you get to be in the business and you get to have these experiences, it just reinforces how cool it is. Oh, and I can't forget, one of my idols as a young character actor is Randy Quaid. Was Randy Quaid. And he was one of the guys that I always wanted to work with. I mean, I saw him in Last Detail and I thought he just killed, and yeah. Okay, so he's going to be in the movie. So getting a chance to do a scene with Randy Quaid was a blast, and it was as good as I could possibly have dreamed it to be. We later worked again on a movie called The Paper, a thing that my brother did, but that was quite a few miles ago for Mr. Quaid, and hope all is well there. And boy, oh boy, it's nice every once in a while to stop and talk about the Wraith, because, you know, even if you're a very successful actor, you're only going to have a handful of these movies in your life, And it's good to stop and smell the roses every once in a while. Anyway, you guys have a good rest of the evening.
So tell me, like, what made you track the film down, like, on Blu-ray? Because I had no idea that there was a high def release of
it. It was purely by chance. I just went to all the eBays. I like to troll through, like, German eBay and right. those places and just looking up 80s cult films. And this one just jumped out at me. I didn't know it had a Blu-ray release anywhere. And I thought, fuck it, that's perfect for us. Let's do an episode.
So, man. Well, good choice, dude, because it's been a number of years since I've seen it, and I'm really glad that you brought it to the table.
Gave us a chance to have Clint on.
Loose.
He's getting loose.
Loose. Loose.
It's time for Guilty Pleasures.
Guilty Pleasures.
Guilty Pleasures.
I feel the guilt.
I feel the shame. I'm feeling it now as I speak to you. Yes, Glenn, Guilty Pleasures. Oh,
well, the first words that popped up on my screen are, it's so stupid, really, really dumb. Mm. And that just encapsulates what we just went through.
Mm.
Guilty pleasures.
I feel ashamed and I feel stupid.
All
right, but do tell, like, what is your guiltiest pleasure?
Okay, mine is a fairly recent film.
Right, am I going to have a little guess?
Yeah, we do the guessing game. That's right. That's what we do. Okay.
I'm ready.
I haven't actually thought of what I can say to
give us a year.
A year? I haven't even written that down. Okay, let me just pluck a year out of my...
Tell me the title and I'll give you the year.
All right, I'm going to say 2014, maybe?
Fuck, that's pretty recent.
Maybe 15.
Right, okay, that's really recent.
What can I say? Everything I say will give it away.
Okay.
I'll give you a few actors in it, which are really surprising.
Okay.
Ted Levine?
No. Levine? No. Is that Adam...
No, that's the guy that plays, like, Buffalo... Is he the guy? Yeah, Buffalo Bill. You know.
Puts the lotion.
Felicity Huffman.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Ray Stevenson.
Mm.
Jim Broadbent.
Right.
Samuel L. Jackson. Directed by Jalmari Hollander.
No.
And he's the guy that made Rare Exports. You know the Santa movie?
Yeah. I watched that with
This is his follow-up Christmas. Film to Rare Exports.
It's not that action movie, Big Game, or something. Yes. Because you put that on Facebook or something recently, or someone said something about it, and you commented on it.
I commented on it.
I haven't seen it. No, it looked pretty cool. I like the art on the slick. It
is fucking great. And right? I'm not gonna prat on about this one for too long. I will just merely read what I've got on my screen because it sums it up perfectly. Super stylish, amazing wilderness aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the refrigerator scene from Crystal Skull, or even the waterfall scene,
and how
absurd that is.
Yeah.
Big Game is 90 minutes of that.
Right, okay.
It is just one extreme to the next. It's all about the President of the United States. His plane crashes, the terrorism thing. In the middle of the, I think, is it Russian wilderness? No, not Russian. Where is it? Somewhere in Europe.
Right.
Scandinavia, Eastern Europe. Crash lands, he's on his own. And coming to his rescue is a little boy who has been sent out on kind of his version of the walkabout. So he's out becoming a man. He's got a hunt, but he's a kid that is that has the community around him has no faith. I don't think he'll
Is Samuel Jackson the president?
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
Yes, and the fact that this kid, none of his parents, his grandparents, the community, they don't think he will make it. Blah blah blah. But he does. He comes to the rescue, and all is good in the end. But
and he's the aid of Samuel Jackson getting him out of the wilderness.
Yes.
Right. So the President of the United States is dependent on a small child on walkabout in some Eastern European forest somewhere.
And
it sounds great already.
It is a brilliant film. The special effects are great. It's hokey. It's deliberately hokey. Yeah. I think a lot of people miss that.
Right.
I think people just went, oh, this is dumb. This is stupid. Well, yes, it is.
But that's what it's intended to be.
It's a schlock film, so... That's all I've got to say. Check it out.
I had a low-key release here. I think it went straight to DVD.
And I think that's why. I think they realised that this film's not going to play well with a lot of people.
Right,
they
right.
will just think, as if. I fucking hate it when people go, as if. As if that could happen.
Hashtag as if.
They say, as if.
It's a fucking movie.
That's always my reply. They go, that could never happen. And I'm like, well, you just fucking saw it happen.
Exactly.
The universe they occupy. It did happen, so go fuck yourself. Anyway.
Alright, well, there's that.
Boom.
I haven't seen it, but yet again, another one to add to the growing list of films. I would like for you to guess my film from 1983, but there's no way you're going to get
it. I'm hopeless at this anyway, so but give it a go. Come on, don't write me off that
there's
early.
There's no stars. Actually, there is one star. His name's Jackie Vernon.
Ooh.
But he's not a real star.
Oh, so he's not like the long-lost brother of Troy?
No, it's Troy Byrne. Like the midget from The Lost of Powers. No, he's pretty talentless, to be honest.
Okay.
I'll tell you a little bit more about him soon.
Give me some more hints. More hints.
Yeah, there's really nothing. It was
extremely
cheaply made. There's really not a lot. It's got cannibalism in it. I think that's what I was trying to say.
Okay, all right. Give me some plot, maybe. Or do what you do. Do it.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll just tell you the movie. Let me tell you about the film, then if you can come up with the title.
I've probably never heard of it. Just go for it anyway.
Okay, so it was released in 83. It was shot in 81, but it didn't actually get released until 83 because no one was picking it up for distribution. They said it needs more tits and gore. And so they added that in and finally got distribution. I saw it on video when I was about, I think, 8 or 9.
Yep.
I watched it with my old man. And we watched all of it. It goes probably for 90 minutes. And
that's a long time for a nothing film.
The fact that we sat through 90 minutes is astonishing, especially at the end when Dad turned to me and he said, "I think that's possibly the worst film we've ever watched." I said, "Yeah, it was terrible." 27 years later, Arrow's just released it on Blu-ray and they've done a 2K scan. They've done this scan on it. There's no way this film deserves as great a scan and restoration. It looks incredible. I had it playing through the UHD player on the 4K TV. And it was upscaling, but it just looked amazing. I watched Taxi Driver the other night, and that's a 4K scan, and that movie is made the way it's supposed to have looked, but it still looks very rough. And this looks infinitely better. There's no way it should.
Anyway, what is it?
Okay, the movie's Microwave Massacre.
Oh, fuck.
Have you ever seen this film?
I know.
Oh, my God, it's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
But I bought it because I figured, well, fuck, if Harry's done this restoration, I'm going to do a special edition. There's got to be some worth to this movie. Maybe I was really young and I didn't understand it. Although the film is called Microwave Massacre and the artwork's terrible and the reviews on IMDb are awful, I was like, nah, fuck it, I'm buying it because I need to see if it is as shit as I remember it. Plus, I want to watch all the special features. How the fuck was this shitty movie made? Anyway, let me give you a little synopsis. American comic / poor man's Rodney Dangerfield, and I mean very poor man Rodney Dangerfield. The film was written for Rodney Dangerfield essentially to play the role, but they couldn't afford to get him, so they got this other comic that very much in the same
way. How many movies are there that were supposed to have Rodney Dangerfield?
I don't know, but I almost watched Back to School today, but the wife said no.
Oh.
And I was like, we just did David Keith is the actor from They Live and from The Thing, yeah? David Keith, the actor from Christine, yeah. He's in back to school. But anyway. You got this guy, Jackie Vernon, second rate Rodney Dangerfield. He plays Donald, a construction worker who's struggling with his wife, May's gourmet cuisine. So his solution to that is getting pinching the dog food, cans of dog food, and taking it to work and eating dog food. And then after work, getting leglessly drunk until, in a drunken rage, he ends up killing May. And the next morning he wakes up, oblivious to the fact he killed her. What do I do? So he dismembers her and puts all her body parts in like the spare fridge that's not actually turned on, and the body parts he's wrapped in alfoil are super light, and when he puts them into the fridge they bend and it's just fucking so hokey and shit. So he makes a sandwich later that day. Anyway, he ends up putting her hand in the sandwich. He doesn't realise, he thinks it's like a cut of meat that he's got
the whole hand.
The whole hand is ridiculous. He's even got like the wedding ring on it and shit. Anyway, he has a chew on it, realises, and then it's like, you know what?
It's delicious.
I kind of like it. Yeah, he's probably used to eating dog food and his wife's cooking. Yeah. So, inadvertently, in a way, he becomes a cannibal, and then he proceeds to bring everything from strippers to sex workers to hitchhikers to neighbours back home. They're all female, and generally he gets their tits out and gets them naked first. Doesn't actually have sex with them or anything. Doesn't really seem sexually interested.
No.
It's almost like he wants to work them up into a sexual stupor before he ends up
dismembering them. It's almost like the producers needed more tits and violence.
Precisely. This is an atrocity. This movie is
fantastic.
Because the title, The Microwave Massacre, before May is killed, she buys this industrial high-tech microwave. It is ridiculously large and super prop-like.
Futuristic.
And very futuristic. And he basically uses the microwave to cook the body parts. He takes the body parts into work as well and feeds them to other workers.
Of course he does.
On the construction site. They love it. They said they've never tasted meat like it before. The movie's a piece of shit. But it's fun. Like, Danny woke up while I was watching it in the morning, because I was kind of like, I know this film's super misogynistic, I don't want to have to make a sit through it, and I know it's going to be awful.
Yeah.
So I just don't want to subject it to it. But she walked in when I was watching it. Of course, there's boobs out in that scene. I was like, explained the premise to her. She's like, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, look, I'm so divided. I go, because this movie is truly awful, but I'm having so much fun watching it. I almost feel guilty laughing at the awful sexist jokes in it. But it was a different period. It was the early 80s. Absolutely. And that's what you've got to appreciate it for. The thing that I like most about this movie is the casting of Jackie Vernon in the film, because apparently he was a comic and quite a popular comic at the time. He has absolutely no sense of comic timing. And his delivery, he doesn't know where to put emphasis on words. So the script itself, as bad and bizarre as the story sounds, the script itself isn't actually that bad, but his delivery is fucking awful.
Right.
Like, it is so bad. And it's like he's reading the script for the very first time aloud on screen. That's what it feels like.
Oh my God.
The second thing I like about the movie is the prosthetics. Like, everything's so rubbery and shitty and cheap looking. It's it's something else. But look, that said, I'm definitely keeping it, and Arrow's done a marvelous job restoring it, and that, God knows why.
Well, of course,
for the US and the UK market.
Of course, it came around in that golden age of appliance related.
Totally, yeah, absolutely.
Refrigerator and
yeah.
Not that it's an appliance, but you had stuff definitely in the
incinerator, even the Nail Gun Massacre, all of these type of movies. But yeah, and on top of them doing this amazing restoration, there's an abundance of special features. One of them's called My Microwave Massacre Memoirs, and it's directed by Elijah Drenner, the guy that directed American Grindhouse, and that guy, Dick Miller.
Yeah.
He directs a bunch of special features for like Arrow and Criterion and everybody. And his documentary, apart from the restoration itself, is the best thing. Like, there's no way this film deserves a documentary that's so well put together. But the other thing I really like about watching the documentary, here is some more filmmakers that made a film back in the early 80s that are still deluded in thinking that there is interest and potential for them to make a sequel now.
Oh my God.
But we do a few things differently, and you know, it's definitely on the cards. It's like, it's not on the fucking cards. We're 33 years into the future, and no one has asked for My Microwave Massacre to be released on Blu-ray.
No one knows
a sequel. Exactly. But anyway, look, that said, it is a piece of shit. And I like it that way.
There is no way in hell that Rodney Dangerfield would have done this film.
There's no fucking way!
I've read enough stories to know that despite him having like this, you know, I guess lowbrow filthy persona, that he was really moralistic when it came to his choices with films.
Right,
And he said no to a lot of things, you know, and eventually he did Natural Born Killers, and that sort of, you know, kind of contradicts.
It's true, but because it's that kind of
satire,
it really works well.
Yeah, but this wasn't satirical by the sound of it.
This was far from satirical. It was just awful, but yeah, good awful. Yeah, man, you should totally check it out. Microwave Massacre.
I know. 1,000 questions.
That is all. That's the end of it.
That was fast. That was a fast
time. We plowed through
the fast time. We did. That was a fast time.
Fast time. Clint Howard wasn't in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, was he?
No.
Or was it Rock and Roll High School?
He was in Rock and Roll High School.
Yeah, he was little hustler agent guy.
The name's eluding me, Bauer, some bull. Yeah. I can't remember
that. That's probably my favourite. Yeah.
I was going to say, what was your favourite Clint Howard film?
Probably that. Like, performance-wise.
Yeah.
So many things like that pop into my head that aren't substantial roles, but they stand out.
Yeah,
like whether it's Austin Powers.
I was
going
to say,
Little Nicky, was he Nipple Man? Was he Nipple Man?
Yeah. I was going to say, Evil Speak. I really like Evil Speak.
He did the ice cream one. What was that
ice
called?
Cream Man.
Ice Cream Man.
In the mid-90s. I'd love to see that again. Surely that was... Is that a Roger Corman produced type film?
Don't know. It sounds like it belongs with Microwave Massacre.
Yeah. Well, it's probably much better.
Yeah.
I don't want to fit Clint's
video. It'll be a prequel because it hasn't melted.
But
look, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, obviously, unfortunately, I missed the Melbourne Underground Film Festival screen because I was in Sydney.
Yeah, so we screened 100 Tears and, of course, Blood Moon.
Blood Moon.
Ah, yes.
Classic.
It's fantastic to see these up on the big screen. They look great. I mean, 100 Tears is a very sort of grindhousey exploitation splatter film, so it's going to look grainy but it was beautiful. Like, the red was
just beautiful, blown up. Oh, and how did the print that we got of Blood Moon? Because we got one from a German film collector.
It looked gorgeous.
Yeah, it did.
It was
good.
Really good.
So jealous. I know.
To have that Fright Break restored was great.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's one of those Aussie films that everyone should sort of go back. And I just like it's. It's so bad, so good, bad, so good. Constantly, you know, whether it's the fashion or wearing Billabong t-shirts.
Yeah, and, totally.
You know, all those scenes around the ice cream van or whatever it was. Oh, my God.
And the rock and roll band that play at the high school dance. They're fucking great. Fucking fucking great.
And all I kept thinking was, geez, Jarrett's probably seen this more times than he should have.
I know, I'd love to have seen it. I've never seen it on the big screen, because when it came out, I didn't see it at the movies. I saw it on video as soon as it came out, and I really wanted to see it at the movies, but my parents seemingly didn't want to take me, so that was a shame. Yes. Not that it was, my old man would take me to see horror movies, yeah, but for whatever reason, maybe my old man goes, it's like shit.
Yes, he was probably wise.
Probably wise in that, but yeah, I think it's aged well, because it's always easier to watch these films 10, 20 years later and you know, have that sense of nostalgia and be able to look into it and going, this was really what Australia looked like.
Absolutely. And obviously the little niche thing we had on that night was that director Marcus Cook gave us a little bit of an introduction for the audience and a teaser of his next film, which is called Bloodshock, which is much more of a torture porn kind of.
Right.
It's part of the American Guinea Pig series, which is very much, what do you call that? It's
extreme horror.
Yeah. So anyway, that is on our Facebook page and our YouTube channel. We've uploaded that so you can watch it. He's doing 200 Tears, that's coming next, the sequel.
Yeah. He's got another one of these American Guinea Pig films as well.
Yeah, he's not directing the next one. I think he's stepping back just to focus on the special effects.
Right, yeah.
Joe Davidson, who acted in the first 100 Tears, is directing 200 Tears. So,
right, okay.
Yeah, yeah, but Marcus is doing all the gore.
Yeah,
and he's stepping back so he can put more gore on the screen. So
Excellent.
If you get a chance to see 100 Tears, watch it through the credits, because the little intro to 200 Tears is...
Yeah, at the tail end of the film.
Yeah.
I did see that. Yeah,
and that's a nice little thing that some of the people at the screening had no idea would be there.
Very cool.
Yeah, anyway, so thanks to those that came along. It was great. And that's about it for this episode. Episode 31.
Ooh. 31. It's taken us a long time to get to 31.
It really has.
Because this is now, I reckon this is about the two or three year anniversary now of the show? Must be two.
Yeah.
2000, because we started in about September of 2000.
And I guess we'd average out a month per between episodes, occasionally longer. So anyway, 31. We are 31.
And I got the pick in the next one, I believe. The next focus film.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, well, yeah. We've discussed one that we might do. So
should we have this conversation off mic?
Yeah, I think so. Right, yeah, cool. We'll just leave everyone else wondering. But hey, thanks for listening, and
we'll catch you on the next one. Hopefully it won't be too far away.